Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm here to represent George Owens, who is a habeas petitioner out of the Eastern District of Wisconsin. There are three issues here today. One is an issue of juror bias as a result of a woman named Lavita King, who we later found out was the fiance of Mr. Owens' nephew. Ms. King was on Mr. Owens' jury, and she never disclosed the relationship during
board. She was the fiance of the victim?
Of the victim, yes. I'm sorry. There are too many Mr. Owens involved in this, I think. The second issue is a confrontation issue. Mr. Owens' trial was postponed twice due to the lack of production of Maurice Owens, the victim, and on the day of his third trial, Maurice Owens did not appear. The state disclosed that Maurice Owens had been killed in an unrelated homicide 3 weeks earlier. The final issue is a speedy trial issue, and frankly, the speedy trial issue really dovetails with the confrontation issue. I'd like to begin with the juror bias issue, and we're seeking relief under Section 2254, sub D, sub 2, which is an unreasonable determination of the facts. The Court of Appeals, the State Wisconsin Court of Appeals, concluded that there were no facts presented to show bias in this case, and the district court stated correctly that the general rule is that the Court of Appeals decision is presumed to be correct.
Can you tell me, or describe for me from your perspective, what happened in the trial court when this matter first came to light?
We have a little bit of a problem, Judge, because the entire trial court record was not presented as part of this appeal, and we believe, both Mr. Gansler and I, that much of the voir dire issues weren't actually transcribed. At least that's what we can discern so far. But what I believe happened is that the foreperson sent a note out to the judge saying, we have this juror who's a problem. She's claiming that she's got a relationship with a family member. And it was unclear as to whether it was the defendant himself or some other member of his family. She's not being cooperative. She put her coat over her head. She refused to deliberate. She says she has issues with white police officers, and there were a myriad of problems with respect to that. It's our understanding that while the court was attempting to decide this issue, the jury continued to deliberate and soon thereafter reached a verdict. So the court didn't conduct any kind of immediate voir dire of either the foreperson who sent the note or, more importantly, of the woman who was the subject of the note, Ms. King herself. No one ever made a point of saying, well, you say you have some relationship with someone's family. Who is it? Is it the defendant? Is it his son? Is it his uncle? Who might it be? Nobody made that inquiry.
Do we have any knowledge from the record as to what the position the defense took at this juncture?
It is my understanding that the defense asked for an opportunity to...
I have to say it's your understanding. Is this in the record? Or is it?
I believe there's a statement in the record that the defense asked for a voir dire, but that it was not... that the judge said, well, I'm going to consider this later. Apparently what happened, Your Honor, is that the court said we're going to reconvene after the jury renders its verdict to decide all this and denied a request to question Ms. King immediately about the contents of the note. The record site I have in my brief is R8, Exhibit C, at page 19.
But the trial court didn't at any point go back to this, did he?
No, she did not.
Okay.
No, she did not. What happened is she came out at sentencing and said, I have interviewed the foreperson. The foreperson told me and, in essence, reiterated the contents of the note, and we're going forward. And
did the defense at that point attempt to make any record as to what it preferred to do, that it preferred to voir dire or anything of that nature?
It appears not.
I see. In Wisconsin, is there a procedure whereby defense counsel could have, in a post-trial motion, ask the judge to give an opportunity to make a record?
There is a procedure under Section 906.06 that deals with extrinsic evidence going to the jury, But my interpretation of that rule, Your Honor, is that it goes more to a juror who brings in a newspaper or who gets a phone call from someone or...
Well, I was thinking of something more generic in terms of a motion for new trial or something of that nature where you could say, you know, that we...
There is a procedure for a post-conviction relief motion.
Yes.
In Wisconsin law, and the issue was raised. It was not raised extremely artfully, in my opinion. However, I believe that it was adequate.
This would be a motion for post-conviction relief?
Post-conviction relief, yes.
I see.
Pre-appeal. And what happened there, at least what the Court of Appeals determined happened there, was that Mr. Owens did not present sufficient facts to establish that there was any bias. In fact, the conclusion was that it was just as likely that Ms. King was biased for Mr. Owens instead of against Mr. Owens, which frankly
is illogical. So that was the trial court took that position?
The trial court took that position, and the Court of Appeals echoed that position.
And apparently no motion made or anything to make that factual record?
Well, it was part of a multi-faceted post-conviction motion.
Yeah.
That attacked not only the juror misconduct in the throwing the coat over the head and the juror bias in, based on the relationship, but also the introduction of the preliminary hearing testimony and the denial of a right to a speedy trial.
If I may ask you one more question, and I'll
Certainly.
Leave you alone. With respect to as I understand, Wisconsin is also another post. Conviction remedy after the first appeal, am I correct?
That is correct, a 974-06 motion.
Yeah, and under the 974-06 motion, was this brought up at all? Could it have been?
It could have been, yes. I know that Mr. Owens filed his petition for review with the Wisconsin Supreme Court, including that issue, and it was denied. And I believe that he immediately, or soon thereafter, filed a habeas petition in either the Eastern or Middle District of Tennessee, because by that time he was incarcerated in Tennessee.
I see.
Then there's another issue with respect to this juror, because of what your client's son told him about this.
That is correct.
Juror, and. When was it? Is it established clearly when it was the son told your client about this problem, about the possible relationship between her and the victim?
Is it established clearly?
Well,
I'm not trying to be facetious, Your Honor. No, it's not.
Because I looked at, the son's affidavit and looked at your client's affidavit, and it's not apparent from that when it occurred.
No, it's not. Unfortunately, it is clear to me that it did not happen during the trial,
mm-hmm.
and that it did not happen when the post-conviction motions were prepared. Now, when it happened between the post-conviction motion preparation, whether it happened before the hearing on the post-conviction motion or during the appeal process, I frankly do not know. And that I made an inquiry. Unfortunately, neither Mr. Owens Sr. nor Mr. Owens Jr. could pinpoint that day particularly, because it had happened 2 or 3 years before I got involved into the case, and they just could not recall. They knew it was during a particular time frame. They knew it wasn't during the trial or immediately afterwards.
All right, so that's why you're saying you're certain about that, because they indicated it wasn't during that time frame,
yes.
that earlier time frame. And then in terms of the affidavit, because, one of the questions here is diligence.
Yes.
And do the affidavits really speak to whether or not you were diligent in an effort to create the record at the state court level?
Well, first of all, I would just like to clarify that I wasn't counsel at the state court level. They don't use the word diligence. I will acknowledge that. The words due diligence do not appear in the affidavits. However, I believe that the circumstances set forth in the affidavits combined, or the facts set forth in the affidavits, combined with the circumstances that are of record, establish due diligence. This is not a situation where Mr. George Owens, he indicated he didn't know this woman. He had no idea who his nephew was dating at the time, and George Jr. never came up to him after the funeral and said, Maurice is dead. I mean, George Jr. was at the funeral.
Right.
But he never told his father that his nephew had died. I mean, in my family, that's incomprehensible to me, but I don't know this family. I don't know what their inner workings are. But for whatever reason, George Jr. didn't take it upon himself to think it was important.
But that clearly occurred before the trial.
Yes.
The length of time.
Absolutely. Because Maurice Owens died on October 4th. That was something that I discovered when I found his birth certificate or death certificate, but the Eastern District Judge Gorenz took judicial notice of that fact that he had died 3 weeks before the trial. With respect to the juror bias issue, we're looking for relief under 2254D2, as I said. Alternatively, we would seek an opportunity for an evidentiary hearing. As Judge Williams just pointed out, there's a lack of diligence issue here. And I believe that an evidentiary hearing would allow I believe that he's established enough facts in the affidavit of himself and his son to allow him to have an evidentiary hearing. And I think that it's important to recognize that the issue isn't whether the information was available or if the information existed, contrary to Judge Gorenz's conclusion. The issue under the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Williams is whether the petitioner and counsel failed to diligently seek it out. And in this circumstance, they had no opportunity, really, or no reason to know that it existed. I would just quickly, I know I'm into my rebuttal time, point out that with respect to the preliminary hearing, we seek relief under 2254D1 on grounds that the court incorrectly and unreasonably applied Green and Roberts, given the unique circumstances of the Milwaukee County prelim court, which allows no meaningful cross-examination whatsoever, as evidenced by Mr. DeLosto's affidavit, and the speedy trial issue is also an unreasonable application under 2254.
I just have one question related to the second issue. Was there any affidavit or any testimony indicating that that was not the practice? That is, you know, the lawyer, and you just mentioned his name.
Mr. DeLosto.
Right, indicated that that was the practice, that you didn't get into issues of bias in the preliminary hearing. Was there any contrary evidence presented?
No.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Keppel. Ms. Keppel, for planning purposes, we're going to add 3 minutes to your time since you can get have a rebuttal. He asked a lot of questions of you. We'll hear now from Mr. Gansner, and please put 3 minutes on Mr. Gansner's time as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is William Gansner. I'm an Assistant Attorney General for the State of Wisconsin and represent Matthew Frank, the appellee in this case. As Ms. Keppel has noted, there are three issues before the Court. The principal issue that Ms. Keppel is arguing is the claim by Mr. Owens, George Owens, or George Owens Sr., of the denial of a right to an impartial jury. In that respect, the relief that is sought by the petitioner is the setting aside of the vacating of the conviction, or alternatively, the conducting of an evidentiary hearing. It's the State of Wisconsin's position in this court, Your Honors, that the defendant, the petitioner, Mr. Owens, is entitled to neither the vacating of his conviction, nor should he be entitled to the conducting of an evidentiary hearing. In our view,
there seem to be a lot of questions as to what went on, though.
There are a number of questions as to what happened in this case, Your Honor. Of the things that we do know, for instance, that the entire transcript of proceedings in the trial court did not come in. It is Ms. Keppel's belief and mine that the initial jury selection, the voir dire of prospective jurors, was not reported and was not transcribed, which is a matter for counsel to request in the trial court under established Wisconsin practice. So we don't know what questions were asked of Ms. King during the jury selection process and what questions were asked and what answers may have been given. We do know, and I think the record is relatively clear, I think there is no dispute between the parties, that what happened at the time the jury was, about what happened when the jury was deliberating. And I think Ms. Keppel's answers to the court revealed, and the parties I think have revealed and indicated in their briefs, that there's really no disagreement about what happened. The judge got a note from the foreperson who reported that a juror, that she had concerns about the one of the jurors, who had indicated that she knew, and I think it is fair to say, that the record revealed some confusion as to what was initially reported by the judge, what the judge said at the time, as to whom the foreperson who was reporting on what Ms. King was saying, as to what, who Ms. King was revealing that she had a relationship with, whether it was the defendant himself, George Owens, who was on trial, or whether it was his nephew, Maurice Owens, who was the victim of the reckless endangerment or the shooting in this case. But we do know that what the jury foreperson reported to the judge, that there was a member of the jury who had revealed some knowledge about people involved in the trial, exactly who it was. There was some confusion at that point. There is reason to look at what the judge said at the time, and I'd be less than candid if I didn't acknowledge this. There is reason to believe that when the judge read or informed the parties of what the foreperson had said, there's reason to believe that the judge believed the foreperson was referring to Ms. King having indicated that she had a relationship with the defendant, because it was a reference to the person on trial. We now know that her relationship was with the victim, Mr. Owens, who died before the case actually went to trial. But we also know that while the parties were discussing this, or immediately thereafter, and I think there is no dispute about this, the court was informed, the judge and counsel were informed that the jury had rendered a verdict, and of course they returned a verdict of guilty.
Counsel, you indicated a practice, at least in the area, that there's no, at least, is the reporter present during the voir dire?
During voir dire, reporters, yes, Your Honor, reporters are present, but there's a question about whether or not the it's transcribed, and that a transcript of the reporter's notes were prepared. And that apparently did not happen here.
But it could have, at some point along, a request to have this juror's responses to questions, the transcript.
Well, no, as I understand it, that is correct. It could have been done. The information could have been put before the court. The defendant could have sought to prepare, have the transcript prepared, and present this information to the court in the post-conviction motion. The panel's questions previously to Ms. Kepler raising questions about what was or was not done by way of post-conviction motion, and I think there also need not be any dispute here. Wisconsin's post-conviction process as part of the precedent to the direct appeal gives the defendant an opportunity to make a motion for post-conviction relief, a new trial motion, challenging the jury verdict or challenging the conviction prior to taking a direct appeal. Once a direct appeal has been concluded and any issues that were raised on the post-conviction motion before the direct appeal and then the direct appeal has been concluded, a defendant also has an opportunity to bring a collateral post-conviction relief motion under Wisconsin Section 97406 if the defendant can demonstrate why any new issue raised on that motion could not have been raised before. The defendant, in this case, Mr. Owens, did do the initial pre-direct appeal post-conviction motion. He then took a direct appeal. He did not...
Did he raise this issue?
He raised the issue of a denial of the right to an impartial juror, but he did not raise the factual information with respect to what the specific factual information with respect to the possibility of juror bias in this case. We did not, for instance, raise an affidavit that was presented 3 years later in connection with the habeas case.
What could he have done?
Well, it is our belief, and I think this panel's questions of Ms. Keppel fairly raised this question, that since in 2000, the petitioner secured an affidavit from his son, George Owens Jr., that said in 2000, at a funeral, which actually took place in early October of 1997, 3 weeks before Mr. Owens went to trial, that his son had seen LaVita King, the juror, at Maurice Owens' funeral. It is our belief that due diligence on the part of the defendant and counsel could have secured prior to trial. Certainly after trial or during the jury selection, when it became known that Lavita King was going to be on the panel, certainly by the time of the jury rendering a verdict, certainly by the time that the defendant brought a post-conviction motion, and certainly by the time that the defendant took a direct appeal, all of this could have been known, that Lavita King was, as alleged 3 years later in 2000, someone that the defendant's son, and it is to be remembered the defendant's son was not just some abstract third party here, the defendant's son was a witness at the trial in late October 1997. So presumably the defendant's son, sitting on the witness stand and testifying in late October 1997, could look into the jury box and see a person that 3 weeks earlier, we're told 3 years later, he had seen at the funeral of the victim. So that's information that surely could have been known, and with any genuine diligence, could have been known to the defense before a post-conviction motion was made and before a direct appeal was taken. George Owens Jr. was in fact a witness at his father's trial. He was a reluctant witness, but he was a witness, he was on the witness stand, he surely knew, if we are to credit what he said in 2000 as truthful at all, he surely knew in October of 1997 when he testified at the trial, that there was a member of the jury that he knew, and that he knew, so he alleges in 2000, had a relationship with the then-deceased victim, Maurice Owens. So we believe that's information that the defense could have presented, should have presented in the state court. And that's why we've raised an argument, really, that goes to the matter of fair presentment, whether or not the state courts were ever fairly presented with the operative facts upon which George Owens relied and built his claim as he presented it in the district court in Milwaukee, his claim of denial of the rights of an impartial jury. He did not present the state courts with those facts that 3 years later he would present to the district court in his habeas petition, and we believe those facts were available to him and could have been presented.
And certainly your conclusion is based on, I guess you're making the strong inference that he would have seen this particular juror at the time he was testifying, but the affidavits are certainly not clear as to when that information was provided.
No, it's not. In fact, George Owens's affidavit, neither George Owens Sr. or Jr. make clear when George Owens Jr. told his father, George Owens, or told his father's attorney about information that he surely knew much earlier. The affidavits do not say, but I think it is fair to conclude that that information, if it's truthful at all, if there's any basis for crediting it with reliability, was information that George Owens Jr. knew far earlier, and any diligence on the part of the defense in this case should have disclosed it and it should have been available.
Well, certainly, given all the factors involved in this case, the district court could have taken those affidavits into account. It's at least based on my reading of what the district court did, the district court just rejected those affidavits out of hand, thinking that the court couldn't even consider them. And what's your position relative to that? Because I think the court could have considered those affidavits.
I think Magistrate Judge Gorenz could have considered them.
Right.
The magistrate judge,
I guess I should say,
did rule them out. I did not consider them. But I think it is fair to look at this record and to come to the conclusion that had the magistrate judge considered them, it would have been entirely reasonable for her to conclude that the vagueness of the information presented did not raise a substantial question as to whether the defendant had supported his claim of juror bias. We don't know when the information was made available. There is, I think, a real question. There's no specificity, as Your Honor has pointed out, in either George Owens or George Owens Jr.'s affidavit as to when the information was made available, and whether the information, in fact, could have and should have been made available back in 1997 or in 1998 when Mr. Owens was pursuing a post-conviction motion prior to his direct appeal. So I think if the judge had taken it into account, we don't think the motion, we don't think the affidavits were dispositive or influential.
Now, what about the, why don't you move to that issue of the preliminary hearing? There was no evidence presented that that was not the general practice, that is, in terms of the purpose of that preliminary hearing, which is basically a probable cause finding. And when you look at the cross-examination, counsel did try to get into issues of bias, and the court sustained the objection.
Your Honor, I'd characterize the three questions to which objections were sustained as questions that, I don't know that it's fair to characterize them as questions going to bias. They were questions, I think, going to details about whether or not George Owens was angry with Maurice Owens before shooting at him. I don't know that that really goes to a question of credibility on what was the issue before the circuit court at that point. And you're absolutely correct. The purpose of preliminary hearings in Wisconsin, as they are in most states that rely upon the preliminary hearing as a screening device to determine whether or not a case should go to trial, is to determine whether there is probable cause for the case to proceed. And we did not dispute Mr. Belasco's affidavit because I think it is clear that under Wisconsin law and the case of State versus Dunn and other cases that have been cited in the briefs, that Wisconsin law does impose some limitations on the kind of inquiry that is to be conducted at a preliminary hearing, because the real question is, as Dunn and other cases have made clear, the question is plausibility, not credibility. So detailed, lengthy inquiry into the credibility of witnesses is not generally permitted at preliminary hearings in Wisconsin, and the issues are generally confined to the elements of the offense. Is the testimony presented by the witnesses plausible? Frankly, I view this as an attempt by Wisconsin, as well as I think in many other states that impose similar restrictions on preliminary hearings, to keep preliminary hearings in Wisconsin to a reasonable limit, as opposed to
California,
where preliminary hearings can go on longer than trials in many states. But I don't really think that the objections that were sustained here went to issues of credibility. I think they went to issues of detail that at that point did not appear to be particularly pertinent, and I question whether they were even pertinent at trial. Our position is that while Wisconsin law does impose limitations on how far, on how wide-ranging inquiry can be of the state's witnesses at a preliminary hearing, that nonetheless an adequate opportunity was provided to cross-examine the witness on the salient points of his testimony. We don't really see in this case, and the defense has never, the petitioner has never really put forward in the state court or in the federal court any genuine challenge to the credibility of Maurice Owens. The facts in this case were awfully clear. There apparently was an argument between Maurice Owens and George Owens, Sr., that ended in Maurice Owens apparently fearful going into his house and closing the door, George Owens retrieving a shotgun, coming to the porch and firing at the door that Maurice Owens had just closed in order to go into his house. The testimony in this case further at trial was that the police came, it was reported immediately, the police came, examined the home, found evidence that yes, in fact, a shotgun had been discharged, found pellets in the door, some of them even went through the door and were in the home. And then at trial as well, George Owens Jr., the defendant's son, testified to what had happened, that there was a confrontation between Maurice Owens and George Owens. He then was reluctant to testify about the actual discharging of the shotgun, and his prior inconsistent testimony at the preliminary hearing was put in, and that testimony did in fact, his prior inconsistent statement given in a statement he gave to the police under investigation, not during the preliminary hearing, was introduced. And in that statement, on the day of the investigation, the day of the crime, The defendant's son said, yes, my father had discharged a shotgun, fired it towards the door that Mr. Maurice Owens had just gone through. So we don't see in the record of the preliminary hearing testimony, and that whole testimony, while there are some problems with the perhaps the full transcript of what happened in the state court not being in this record, the full transcript of Maurice Owens' testimony at the preliminary hearing is before this court as an attachment to the answer. And I think if you look at that, you'll see that there was a full opportunity to cross-examine Maurice Owens on what had in fact happened. And we find in this case any suggestion that there is really an issue over the credibility of his testimony. We find that there is really no basis for any question as to whether what he testified to was credible. That is, the facts of what happened. An argument, and then Mr. George Owens fired a shotgun at a door that he had just retreated behind in order to go into his home. The defendant has never suggested what additional challenge to the credibility of that testimony that he could offer. So, Your Honor, it's our view that there was an adequate opportunity for cross-examination at the preliminary hearing, and that the preliminary hearing testimony did satisfy the grounds for admissibility of that prior testimony under the hearsay exception. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Gassner. Ms. Kemple.
And why don't you begin with that last point? What he could have done in cross-examination that would have brought out credibility problems with the witness?
That's an excellent question, Your Honor. I believe that during cross-examination, counsel could have challenged Maurice Owens' statement of what happened, what led to the argument. Mr. Owens was George Owens was charged with first degree of reckless homicide. First degree reckless endangerment. It's possible that he might have had an opportunity to seek a second degree, a lesser offense, depending on what led up to this argument. There would be questions asked of Mr. Owens as to whether where he was in the house when the shots were fired. Was he behind the door? Was he in the back room? Was he truly and really endangered by his uncle's conduct? Those are questions that we don't know the answer to because only Maurice Owens knows where he was in the house, and there was no opportunity to ask that question of him.
So that's more sort of factual details, but the arguments you're making in the brief is that it affects credibility and bias. Was there anything further?
Well, I think that he would have been able to discuss his relationship with his uncle and what their relationship was like. And was he fearful of his uncle? Was this something that he expected? I don't understand exactly, based on my reading of this family, where they stand. Mr. Gansler raised this issue about George Jr. should have told his father what had happened, and you would think he did, and therefore George Sr. wasn't diligent in seeking the facts of this case. It's clear to me that this is not a family that many of us embrace in our own life. This is a family where people obviously don't talk to each other, but we certainly can't impute George Owens Jr.'s knowledge of Lovita King onto George Owens Sr. or his lawyer. And I think the same thing holds true with respect to what Mr. Owens did and what his knowledge was and what his credibility would have been and what his bias was. I mean, those are issues that are somewhat mysterious and enfolded in all these shadows that we have here. But I think it's something that Mr. Owens Sr. at least should have had the opportunity to inquire into. I would like to make a point about the affidavits. Mr. Gansler, answer, I think I'm pronouncing your name right. I'm sorry. I think, Judge Williams, you're correct in believing that Judge Gorin should have considered those affidavits under the fair presentment rules. The petitioner must simply have presented and described the facts and legal theory under which he was seeking relief in the state court. And I believe that Mr. Owens did do that. Did he have the specific facts that were submitted in the affidavit? No. But were there sufficient facts so that the court clearly understood that he was challenging Lovita King's position on the jury? Absolutely. And it's clear to me, based on the U.S. Supreme Court's decision on Williams, that factual affidavits with respect to what happened are admissible. In Williams, the court which decided a case which also involved a similar jury bias issue, that they specifically referred to factual affidavits that were filed in the court, in the federal court. As for the jury selection, there was some question as to what happened in the voir dire. I believe I mentioned in my brief that I requested the court take judicial notice of the fact that Milwaukee County, in every courtroom in Milwaukee County, the standard jury questions are posted. And one of those questions is, do you know the defendant? Do you know any of the witnesses? And the witnesses are identified. And Ms. King apparently did not answer yes to any of those questions, because if she had disclosed her relationship, there's no way she would have been on that jury.
Was the trial judge under some independent duty to take that matter further? Apparently, my problem is that the defense didn't do very much.
I believe that the trial judge was under an independent duty to take that matter further. The trial judge is the gatekeeper of the jury and is the gatekeeper of her courtroom, and it's her job to make sure that the jury is impartial. And when she has knowledge that she's got a juror who's got some issues and has expressed some relationship with someone on the defense side, well, not the defense side, but some member of the defendant's family, when they're on opposite sides of the aisle, if you will, because one is a victim and one is the defendant, and she doesn't even bother to ever interview or allow a voir dire of that particular juror.
Was she ever asked for a voir dire?
I believe she was.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that's that site that I noted earlier. I believe that counsel requested an opportunity to voir dire, and it was denied.
That's that record at 8 Exhibit C.
That's correct. That's my recollection of where
that
was.
The judge talked with the foreman, the foreperson. Did she also talk to the juror herself?
No. And that's my biggest problem with what she did. She never talked to the juror herself.
Right. She didn't ask counsel to be there when she interviewed the foreperson.
That is correct. That interview
was a record made of that? With the juror?
I apologize, Johnny. I didn't mean to jump on you.
That's okay.
I believe not. I have not found any evidence of any record of that discussion. I believe it was an in-chambers discussion.
What's the practice when there are juror problems, since there's no automatic transcript made of voir dire? How is it raised in Wisconsin state courts when you have that issue?
If there are juror problems, if a note comes out, the court goes on the record, states that there is a question, asks the question, then counsel, at least as what I believe happened in this case, asks for the opportunity to address that question, either with the court or, in this case, what counsel did was ask the opportunity to address the matter with the particular jury. The court said no. We're going to let them go ahead, make their decision, come to a verdict, and then we'll reconvene later and discuss it. There was no reconvention, if you will. What happened is the parties appeared at trial or at sentencing, and the court announced that she had a private conversation with the foreperson. The foreperson told her basically what she had said in the note, and that as a result, this is my ruling.
And the jury was discharged and never brought back.
That is correct. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Keppel. And thank you, Mr. Gazin, as well.